Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering kayaks, canoes, and outdoor equipment for anyone wanting to experience the natural beauty of Wisconsin water. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or rutabagashop.com.
It's likely that every war has had people who opposed it for political, religious, or personal reasons. But the long, murderous grind that was World War I may have had the largest opposition of them all. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. We'll find out who opposed World War I and what became of them. We'll find out from historian Adam Hochschild. He is the author of various books, including To End All Wars, and has also been a commentator on National Public Radio's All Things Considered, and he is a lecturer at Berkeley. Welcome to University of the Air.
Good to be with you, Norman.
If we talk about the opposition to World War I, we really can't talk about opposition building up to it, can we, since it broke out so suddenly?
It broke out suddenly and unexpectedly. There were people who saw it coming and who spoke out very forcefully on that score. For example, the French socialist leader Jean Jaurès was someone who saw the war coming for months in advance, spoke out forcefully on that. And about a week before the war began, he was one of the leaders from all of Europe's left-wing parties who had an emergency meeting in Brussels trying to forestall this conflict. And at that meeting, they went outside and in front of an enormous crowd in a plaza there, he put his arm around the shoulders of the German socialist leader, Hugo Haase, and said, "We will never make war on each other." And because of that, when Jaurès returned to France 3 days later, he was assassinated. 3 days after that, the war began.
So how could they see it coming? Was the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife just really something that was going to happen one way or the other?
Well, I'm not so sure. The assassination of the Archduke, June 28th, 1914, was the thing that set the train of events in motion. But the curious and fascinating thing to me about World War I is that it didn't have to happen. At that time, June 1914, Germany was Britain's biggest trading partner. There were some 50,000 Germans who were working in England because wages were a little bit higher there. The majority of the honorary degrees that went to foreigners at Oxford and Cambridge that year went to Germans. The royal families of Britain, Germany, and Russia were all related. The Russian Tsar and German Kaiser had sometimes vacationed together on their yachts in the Baltic. No country in Europe, no major country in Europe, openly claimed a piece of another's territory, and that's usually what starts wars.
Sure.
There were all kinds of tensions under the surface, but there were none of those overt causes of war that usually make you think, okay, this is bound to explode sooner or later. But it was this odd chain of events set in motion by the assassination of the Archduke that one thing led to another very, very quickly.
And so at what point then does this war become something that people have never seen before? I mean, we're in a sense, we're coming out of the 19th century.
Right.
But now suddenly things are different.
I think when we say something they'd never seen before, we have to specify that they'd never seen before in Europe, because Europe had been fighting colonial wars in Africa, India, the Far East for many, many years. And I think for people on the receiving end of European firepower in those wars, they felt, we've seen war like nothing we've ever seen before. But this was something new to Europe, because here, for the first time, you had heavily industrialized countries on both sides. Both sides had machine guns. Both sides had immensely powerful long-range artillery. Both sides had every weapon you could think of. Even if one side developed it first, then the other side came along and did the same thing. And the level of destruction was absolutely unprecedented. For example, once the war began, and in Western Europe that meant the beginning of August 1914, actually Austria-Hungary had fired the first shots at the end of July, you know, by late August, there were on one single day 27,000 French soldiers killed in one day. No country had seen anything quite like it before. And it repeated itself, you know, 2 years later, the Battle of the Somme, July 1st, 1916, more than 21,000 British soldiers killed or fatally wounded in a single day, the bloodiest day in the history of the British Army, before or since.
I was surprised to learn that something as simple as barbed wire was such a shocking innovation to charges during World War I.
It's true. The two of the weapons that defined the First World War were barbed wire and the machine gun. And both were basically defensive weapons. You know, you can't charge forward
with either
at a full run carrying either of those things. And they were extraordinarily effective defensive weapons. When you add to them also the, you know, digging trenches, which has been around for a while longer, you know, you have a deep trench, you have machine gun nests, which are, you know, more likely than not protected by concrete fortifications so that anything but an absolutely direct hit, it will survive. And then you have barbed wire in front. And these barbed wire defenses were extraordinary. What the Germans were particularly good at this, what they would often do is to dig a shallow but wide trench that might be, you know, 20 or 30 yards wide and miles long and fill the whole thing with barbed wire. And that made it almost impossible for anybody to advance past it. And of course, all of this upended everybody's idea of how war ought to be conducted, which was, of course, giving the position of glory to the cavalry charge. Both sides had enormous numbers of cavalry. When the Germans invaded France and Belgium in 1914, they had 8 cavalry divisions, 40,000 men on horseback. But try a cavalry charge against even a single line of barbed wire. You won't get anywhere. And add to that, try a cavalry charge against a machine gun. So that didn't work. That had to be scrapped, essentially.
And the trench warfare settled in how quickly?
Within the first 2 or 3 months.
So really stagnated.
Yeah.
That fast.
And for... There was some movement back and forth in the opening months of the war, but by October, November 1914, both sides were dug in on the Western Front. The Eastern Front was different, but the Western Front, that is stretching from the English Channel to the Swiss border, there was a line, a curving line of trenches, which basically moved not at all, except for one strategic and carefully planned retreat by the Germans. It didn't move more than a few miles in each direction for well over 3 years. Take the year 1915, for an example, a year when the Allies launched a number of major attacks, probably on the Western Front, more than 1 million soldiers killed or wounded on both sides together during that year. The Allies gained exactly 8 square miles of ground.
It's amazing to think of today, isn't it, where
things
move so quickly, so far.
Yeah, and it's amazing to think of in comparison with past wars, which likewise were wars of maneuver.
And so at what point then do we see – let's look in England. Let's look at England first. At what point do we see then a popular response that's opposing the war? It's such a strange combination of gallantry and barbarism that we see in this particular conflict.
Yeah. Well, there were opponents of the war in all the major countries, but there were many more of them, particularly at the start in England, for this reason. Britain itself was not attacked in 1914. France and Belgium were attacked by the Germans, and the British joined in because they'd had an unwritten understanding with the French, not formalized by treaty, that they would come to each other's aid in case of war. But Britain itself was not attacked, and the Germans were not wanting and not expecting Britain to join in. Because Britain wasn't attacked, I think that's why there was a stronger anti-war movement there. It wasn't enough to stop the war, but it was vocal, it was outspoken. Many, many people felt strongly it was an enormous mistake for Britain to join this war. And they said so very courageously, and they kept saying so even when that rapidly became a very unpopular thing to say.
Before we look at the thinking of those people in the opposition and maybe even some of the individuals, what then, if Britain hadn't been attacked, was the rationale to go to war?
The rationale was that the Germans had violated Belgian neutrality. There were treaties dating from the 19th century between the major powers that guaranteed that Belgium would be neutral and would be left out of conflicts between Britain, France, Germany, and so forth. And the Germans violated that because Belgium was, for them, on the path to France. So that was the excuse that Britain used. However, personally, I think, and one of the things that one often does with World War I, because it's 100 years in the past, is you play what-if games.
Of course.
I think if the Germans had respected Belgian neutrality and had invaded France solely by the border that they shared, which would have been difficult because the French had heavily fortified that border, I think Britain still would have joined in because a hallmark of British policy for hundreds of years had been not wanting to have a hostile power on the other side of the English Channel. So Britain would have found some other excuse, I think, to join.
And the Germans had already had a war with the French back in 1870-71.
Right, which they had won, and they had taken Alsace and Lorraine as a prize, and there were many people in France who were eager to get those lost provinces back again. And I think that was one reason why there was so much war enthusiasm in France at the start.
What did Britain expect to gain? Anything other than just keeping a hostile nation away from the English Channel?
I think that was the main thing that Britain cared about. You know, the English Channel comes very close. The other side of the English Channel, I think it's 21 miles across
right.
at the nearest point.
You can swim it.
you can swim it. And they didn't want a hostile power there. They saw Germany as a hostile rival power with whom they were already in a naval arms race of sorts and with whom they were already had disputes over colonies in Africa and so forth.
And that security or the wish to preserve that security did not sway those who came to oppose the war in Britain?
No, it didn't, because these were people who said, and rightly so, I think, they should be celebrated, who said, this war is going to cost millions of lives. It's not worth our fighting in. It's a mockery to say, as the war propaganda very quickly started to do, that we're fighting for democracy against, Imperial Germany and the Kaiser and so forth. It's nonsense to say that when the third principal ally was Tsarist Russia, which was the last absolute monarchy left in Europe. It made no sense at all. And furthermore, many of the people in Britain who opposed the war, who tended to be on the political left, also said it makes a mockery to say that we're fighting for democracy when all of the countries involved are still holding on to their colonies. And the war also fairly quickly became a colonial land grab, with each side wanting to grab the other's colonies.
So often a war is said to be fought by the lower classes on behalf of the upper classes. But this war was different.
It's true, and that's something sort of haunting about it for me. When you think of recent American wars, for example, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, there are very, very few University of Wisconsin graduates, very few, you know, children of senators or corporate CEOs or whatever, who lost their lives in these wars. It was the poor did most of the dying. In the First World War, the upper classes on both sides suffered disproportionately because it was young captains and lieutenants who led their men out of the trenches. The officer has to go first, set an example out in front, into these relentless barrages of machine gun fire, and they went down. And anywhere you look at the statistics, they're just appalling. The chance of being killed for the average guy in the British Army was 11%. For peers and sons of peers, it was 19%. Men who graduated from Oxford in the year 1913, 31% were killed. So it, and the same similar statistics in the French, German, and Russian armies. And armies in those days were very much officered by the elites. This had been a tradition, of course, for hundreds of years. There was an additional reason backing up that tradition in the latter part of the 19th century, in the years before the First World War, which was that armies in Europe at that period were very frequently used as strikebreakers.
Sure.
And you certainly couldn't risk putting an officer of working class background in charge of an operation like that. Heaven forbid he might sympathize with the strikers. This was something they were very worried about. So armies remained controlled by the elites. The elites supplied the young officers, and they, you know, went down by the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands.
We imagine the combatants, certainly on the British side, as being all in, you know, sort of olive drab uniforms. But apparently there was still some holdover from the 19th century in terms of just the visibility of these officers and therefore their vulnerability.
That's true. One of the amazing things to me is if you look at the pictures of the combat uniforms of the armies as they went to war in 1914. Now, there's a lot of olive drab and there's field gray by the Germans and so forth. But even among the Brits, Scots wore sort of tartan headbands around their caps, colored headbands in plaid, which certainly would provide a good target for an enemy sniper. Belgian troops wore top hats, you know, like magicians' top hats. And you see pictures of these guys with top hats and rifles in the firing position. Quite amazing. The most extraordinary of all was the French infantry, who wore bright red caps, bright blue coats, bright red pantaloons. You couldn't be a more conspicuous target for somebody if you tried. You know, hunters who don't want to get shot in the woods, what color do they wear? Red. And Austro-Hungarian cavalry also wore bright red and blue, and they didn't give up that uniform until 1916.
And you haven't mentioned helmets yet.
That's right. Most people didn't think of helmets. The Germans had helmets, but they were made of leather initially. Fairly quickly, both sides realized, hey, we need metal helmets that'll stop a bullet. But where does this come from, this idea that it's more important to look good than to look camouflaged when you're facing the enemy?
It goes back a long way, doesn't it?
It goes back a long way, and I think the reason that it was still in the minds of the generals at that time and that they didn't stop to think about it was that for the British, French, and German generals who were running this war, indeed officers of all ranks, their most recent actual military experience had been fighting colonial wars in Africa, Asia, Far East, up against colonial rebels or people whose territories they were conquering. And these were folks who didn't have repeating rifles, didn't have machine guns. Heaven knows whether they were more frightened of somebody wearing red and blue than khaki. But people wearing those bright colored uniforms often didn't have to worry about the enemy shooting at them. They had to worry about swords and spears and, you know, lances. So I think even though they knew intellectually, hey, the other side in this war also has machine guns and repeating rifles, armies think rather slowly, or it takes an idea a long time to percolate down and actually make a change in, you know, something
you
like what the standard uniform is. Yeah.
We're going to look further at the effect that World War I had on the classes and some specific families in England when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Adam Hochschild, and we're looking at opposition to World War I, the Great War, as it was called, I suppose, shortly after it broke out in 1914. In England, there was, as you've said, then not one class, an upper class, driving the lower to fight this war, rather than the upper class suffering, if anything, disproportionately because of the involvement of the officers. But was there even an option for conscientious objector status in England during World War I?
Well, Britain didn't start conscription until a year and a half into the war, the spring of 1916. Up to that point, they had been able to fight with a volunteer army only. There was strong social pressure on people to volunteer, pressure that sometimes became as strong as London municipal employees of military age, for example, found themselves released from their jobs so that they would be free to join up. But it wasn't until the spring of 1916, a year and a half in, that they had to institute conscription. But they thought of conscription as a foreign thing. They looked down on it as an American thing.
Too. Was there no precedent for it in England?
The only precedent was more than a century in the past, the press gangs that essentially kidnapped people into the Royal Navy. But that had gone out more than 100 years ago, 100 years before. So when conscription was finally passed, there were many members of Parliament, including many who were totally in favor of the war, who still felt uneasy about this. And to assuage them, the government made a conscientious objector law where you could claim conscientious objector status. And if you were granted it, you were then assigned other work. But that other work often was driving an ambulance at the front or working in a factory making munitions. For that reason, many of the young Britons who refused conscription, more than 20,000 of them altogether, also refused conscientious objector status because they didn't want to help the war effort in other ways.
What alternative then?
Prison. And more than 6,000 of them went to prison, which was up to that point in time the largest number of people imprisoned for political reasons in a Western democracy.
Was that used as a workforce?
There was labor in some of the prisons, but it was pretty primitive, you know, stitching mailbags and things like that.
So not directed to the war effort?
No, not directly.
And how did they fare, those 6,000?
The conditions were rough because Britain was short of food anyway, and prisons were last in line to get what food there was. Britain was extremely short of coal for heat. Because so many coal miners were at the front instead of mining coal, and prisons were last on the list to get what available coal there was. So in the accounts you read of this time, people talk about just how freezing cold the prisons were in wintertime. Food was pretty meager, but because these men were there because of what they believed in, they found ways of staying in touch with each other. They were, of course, not supposed to talk to each other, not allowed to congregate, but they published clandestine prison newspapers. We know of 8 or 9 of them. One of them, for example, was produced by a man named Fenner Brockway, who had himself been a newspaper editor before the war. He continued as a newspaper editor in prison, publishing his single edition, so to speak, of a newspaper on toilet paper. In the latrine where other prisoners would see it. It lasted for a year until the authorities found it, shut it down, and put him in solitary confinement on reduced rations for the rest of the war.
So you could get this, I won't call it exactly a conscientious objector status for those who went to prison, but you could, let's say, avoid conscription on religious grounds, but not presumably political grounds.
No, you could claim, and British law then was different from American law, you could claim a religious objection to the war or you could claim a political objection to the war. The interesting thing is that a majority of people claimed a religious objection and a majority of people claimed a political objection. There was a big overlap. The religious objectors were predominantly Quakers who were very much at the heart of this movement. but a great many of them, as with the others who were not religious, felt themselves to be on the left politically, felt that, you know, the working people of Europe shouldn't make war on each other. So there was a both, you know, I'm fascinated by the way that the political culture of the time combined the radicalness of some elements of evangelical Christianity, of Quakerism, and of the socialist movement. You find records of people singing Christian hymns in prison and also singing labor songs.
Was there any kind of sedition law in England as there was in this country? In other words, could you find yourself in prison if you wrote against the war?
Very definitely, and a number of people suffered from it. Britain's leading philosopher, Bertrand Russell, was sent to prison for 6 months because he was a very outspoken opponent of the war. They always found some technicality on which to prosecute somebody, but they wanted him out of circulation. Britain's leading investigative journalist, Edmund Dean Morrell, a very brave man, went to prison for 6 months also, in his case at hard labor. And there were other people, writers, editors, people who published the newspaper of the principal group supporting conscientious objectors, a couple of women. They spent spells in prison also.
There was an individual who suggested in print, I believe, that if the English officers would just divest themselves of all their battlefield servants, that some 60,000 men would be freed for combat. What became of him?
This was a fascinating guy who's a character in my book, To End All Wars. Albert Rochester is his name. He was a labor unionist, member of the National Union of Railwaymen. And before the war, he'd also been a columnist for his labor union newspaper. And he was a supporter of the war. Was in France, and, you know, he was not a war opponent, but he was very class conscious, and he noticed that every British officer had a personal servant. And he wrote a letter to the editor of the Daily Mail in London about this, saying if we could just change this practice, we'd free up 60,000 men for the war effort, and we would win this war more quickly. The letter was intercepted by the censor. Rochester was sentenced to prison, you know, for writing such a thing. When he was in prison, he had another experience of something else. He found himself sharing a cell one night with three men who were working class types like himself, and they had been sentenced to death. They were hoping for a reprieve. They'd been sentenced to death for laying down their arms and fleeing at the time of a German night raid on their trench. And, you know, running the other way is not an unsensible thing to do if you have an enemy
soldier. Some circumstances is a good idea.
Coming into your trench at night. He was very moved by their stories. He, you know, they parted after the night. He was taken to another cell and said, you know, well, I hope you get your sentence reprieved. Instead, the next day, he found himself assigned to a work detail as a prisoner, digging three holes, carrying three wooden posts to be placed in them, and he realized this is where these three men were to be shot. And he witnessed the execution, was put to work cleaning up afterwards, and was absolutely seared by this experience, objected in every way he could. The authorities tried to cause more trouble for him. He began to be afraid he might be killed in prison because they already had it in for him. Managed to get the head of his railway union back home to talk to the prime minister. And so Rochester was released and put in an assignment behind the lines. But he was still seething over this execution. And then after the war, he realized that you know, these three men were representative of something that had happened to many others. The British executed more than 300 young men during the war for disobedience, desertion, laying down arms in face of the enemy, cowardice, whatever.
Is this an unprecedented number?
You know, history is filled with, you know, so much horrible stuff that one hates to say, nothing like this was ever done before. It's the largest recorded number of executions on either side in the First World War.
Compared to, say, World War II.
Although, I have to take that back. Actually, France, there was a larger number because there was an actual large-scale mutinies in the French army. By World War II, the death sentence had gone out of fashion for this sort of thing, in the Western armies anyway. The Germans executed a lot of people at the end of the war. But anyway, Rochester, after the war, took up the cause of these executed men, and he worked together with people who had been in prison as war opponents, and they tried to agitate for a mass reversal of these convictions. They failed. And Rochester died prematurely of an infection in a hospital when he was in the 1920s. But the case of these 300 plus British soldiers who were executed went on for years and years and years, with family members wanting their exoneration, and it became sort of a proxy battle over how to see the war as a whole. And finally, after much public pressure in 2006, the British government did grant them all a pardon. Retroactive doesn't do you much good if you were executed almost 100 years before, but no, it was a symbolic statement.
Does your descendants some good, I guess. Were there outspoken opponents of the war from the upper classes in Britain?
Very definitely. Bertrand Russell, whom I mentioned, was himself the son of a peer and became one when his elder brother died and he inherited the title. Fenner Brockway, the newspaper editor I mentioned in jail, didn't come from a noble family himself but actually earned a peerage during his life. Perhaps the most unexpected upper-class dissenter was Lord Lansdowne, who was out of the cabinet at the time, but had previously, earlier in his life, been both the Secretary for War and Foreign Secretary. And in 1917, he wrote a letter to the editor of the London Times, which the Times refused to publish, and so it had to be published elsewhere, saying this war has gone on too long, and it is killing off too many people, and it especially is killing off too many of our best people, i.e. the upper class people.
How British.
And we should think about a negotiated settlement. And coming from someone so high in the establishment, this was regarded as a terrible scandal. Lansdowne was a very conservative man, not a radical at all, and was startled to find himself now embraced by socialists and radicals whom he had never associated with before.
Strange,
but his efforts were in vain because there was no attempt to negotiate a settlement then or at any other time, really.
What about the whole role of, we have other social causes being espoused vigorously at the time of World War I, suffrage, for example. How did the leaders of the women's movement respond to World War I?
Well, they divided. There had been a very active movement demanding votes for women in Britain right up until the eve of the war, unsuccessfully, but, mass demonstrations and one or two deaths, actually, in those protests. And the leading family of the British movement for women's suffrage was the Pankhursts. Emmeline Pankhurst was the matron of the family. She had two daughters living in England at that time, Christabel and Sylvia. And they all had repeatedly gone to jail in the battle for women's suffrage. Emmeline Pankhurst, the mother, on the eve of the war, had been sentenced to prison for literally throwing a rock through the window of 10 Downing Street, the prime minister's residence.
A very important window.
And when the war broke out, she was actually a fugitive from justice. She'd gone across the British Channel to France to escape being jailed again. The moment the war began, she returned to Britain. She ceased all her suffrage activity, and she and her daughter Christabel put themselves at the service of the British government, which was delighted to have these well-known troublemakers on their side and deployed them on speaking tours throughout the British Isles, in North America, sent Emmeline to Russia at one point to rally Russian women for the war effort. Meanwhile, the other daughter, Sylvia, became one of the war's most outspoken opponents, published the most widely read anti-war newspaper in Britain during the war, several numbers of which were suppressed, spoke out repeatedly against the war, and she and her mother essentially stopped speaking to each other and never resumed for the rest of their lives.
Were there any splits in families that involved these prominent military figures?
Yes. The most fascinating one there is that Sir John French, who was Field Marshal French, who was commander-in-chief of the British Army on the Western Front for the first year and a half of the war, and sort of a classic military figure, you know, mustache, a cavalryman, said to be a little bit bow-legged from all those years of riding a horse, had fought through, you know, 40 years of colonial wars and expeditions in this various parts of the world. He had a sister, Charlotte Despard, who was one of Britain's most outspoken anti-war agitators. She traveled up and down the British Isles speaking against the war. She visited families of war resistors in prisons. Her rallies were often broken up by rock-throwing mobs or shut down by the police. Oddly, this brother and sister were very fond of each other, continued to see each other throughout the war. They stopped speaking only when, in 1918, the British government faced a nationalist rebellion in Ireland, and they thought they needed a military man with a strong hand to suppress it. So they sent Sir John to Ireland as viceroy, and his sister Charlotte went to Ireland to work for the IRA. Mm-hmm. And they stopped speaking at that point.
Well, certainly the Irish conflict stirred deep emotions in the English as well as the Irish. We're going to look further at this opposition to World War I. What kind of opposition was there in Germany and, of course, in the United States, too, when we return in a moment? This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Adam Hochschild, and we're looking at opposition to World War I. We've looked at it extensively as it was in England, but what about the Germans? Was there outspoken opposition to the war there?
It couldn't be outspoken because that wasn't allowed. There wasn't the political space in Germany for people to agitate about this. And those who did try to speak, radicals like Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, were sent to jail. But otherwise, you couldn't publish anything arguing against the war the way one could in England or agitate otherwise. People who refused to be drafted, mostly for religious reasons, were promptly clapped in jail. No conscientious objector status or anything like that. I think the real opposition to the war in Germany really came towards the end as the Germans were losing in 1918. The Army High Command became extremely worried because in early 1918, they had already essentially won the war on the Eastern Front against Russia. But one of the things that happened there is that German and Russian soldiers, after the fighting stopped, began fraternizing, exchanging news in no man's land. The Russians told them, hey, you know, we made a revolution here and overthrew the Tsar.
Oh.
And radical ideas began spreading through the army. And there were, you can find a lot of alarmed communications about this among German generals. Having essentially won the war in the East, the Germans were then eager to transport soldiers from that front to the West, because in March of 1918, they made a huge final offensive against France.
And you have the Americans in the war then,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and they wanted to do this before the Americans got there in large numbers. But as these trains transporting soldiers from the Eastern Front crossed Germany to the Western Front, the trains very often arrived with fewer soldiers on them at the destination than had gotten on back east. People jumped off trains. And in the final weeks of the war, October, November 1914, there was a mass of desertions from German soldiers, not at the front but in the rear areas. People simply disappearing, not showing up, being in transit somewhere and not getting there, and a network of civilians helping these folks began to spring up. This was one of the reasons why the German generals knew they had to sue for peace very quickly, because their army was dissolving from the rear, not from the front.
And this was because, even though they defeated the Russians, this was because things were going badly on the Western Front?
Yes. They had made an all-out attempt to capture Paris and win the war in the West before large numbers of American troops could get there. The United States had actually entered the war in the spring of 1917, but the U.S. had only a tiny standing army. And everybody knew it would take a year or so for American troops to get trained in significant numbers and get to Europe. And by the spring of 1918, this was just beginning to happen, and the Germans wanted to make an offensive, capture Paris, knock France out of the war before the Americans could get there. They were initially quite successful. They developed this stormtrooper tactics where instead of having a file of men marching abreast, you know, directly into machine gun
fire,
you snuck through places that the machine guns couldn't go and took advantage of night and fog and things like that. They were quite successful. They got to the gates of Paris. They stalled there, basically. Americans started arriving, and then they basically couldn't get any further and were forced to retreat. And they retreated and retreated gradually. It was a very bloody process. But by October or so, the German high command knew the war was lost.
It sometimes surprised me to think that for America, the war was really only, what, about 19 months long?
It was, and really in terms of large numbers of American troops being anywhere in or anywhere near combat, it was shorter than that, really only about 6 or 7 months.
And yet we had this phenomenal opposition to the war. Of course, we had 3 years to build up to it in this country.
We did. You had La Follette here in Wisconsin. You had all sorts of people who strongly opposed the war. You had people like Jane Addams, the pioneer social worker, who had in 1915 organized a conference of women from both sides in Holland, which was a neutral country. We had Eugene V. Debs,
the labor leader,
who spoke out very strongly against the war. And because of this, in 1918, was sent to prison here in the U.S. And he was still in prison in November 1920 when he received nearly 1 million votes for president on the socialist ticket.
Well, not terribly different from some other candidates in later years, as it turned out. But we did have in this country, we had the espionage and the then kind of appended to that, I guess, the Sedition Act. But did it come in too late, really, to be a factor in World War One?
Well, wars are never good for civil liberties. And there were several things going on at the same time around that time. There was the U.S. entering the war, and that always, you know, creates a hunt for subversives and who are the traitors among us and so forth. And there was a lot of ire directed at German Americans.
And there were plenty of them.
And there were lots of them. And sometimes businesses with the German names and so on had their windows smashed and so forth. There was a great deal of this in England as well. But then also in 1917, there was the Russian Revolution. And this set off a tremendous Red Scare. And the combination of the two things, I think, led to this very dark period of American history, you know, 1918 to 21 or so, when there was a tremendous amount of political violence directed against anybody suspected of being, you know, a leftist, a pacifist of any sort.
Which got tangled up with the labor movement, too, I suppose.
Right, because for employers, it was a good chance to smash labor unions.
So what kind of effect did the opposition to the war in this country have? I mean, did it have any effect in terms of actually delaying our entry into the war?
I don't think so. I think that even though there was a lot of strong anti-war sentiment, the U.S. had been, you know, trading with, which essentially means supplying arms and other goods on credit with Britain and France since the very beginning. So in some sense, the U.S. was, in a civilian way, so to speak, already in the war right from the start. Cynics said that the reason that Woodrow Wilson brought the United States into the war militarily was so that we could get those loans repaid. I think there were other factors as well. It was hard for Wilson to politically stay out of the war when American ships were being sunk, because the Germans announced unrestricted submarine warfare, which meant that they would sink any kind of ship carrying anything to Britain or France.
The Lusitania being the most famous.
Yeah, even if it was coming from, well, the Lusitania actually was sunk and was a notorious thing, but it wasn't an American ship. But come 1917, they started sinking American ships as well, not just ships carrying Americans. And it's very hard for a president to resist getting swept away when Americans are dying. I mean, look at what President Obama is now going through when ISIS or the Islamic State or whatever you want to call it starts beheading Americans. It creates tremendous pressure for the president to do something. So Wilson was under those pressures. He was also under the illusion that he could somehow preside over the remaking of the world in a way that would produce no more wars or
big
fewer
picture.
Wars after that. And that illusion turned out not to be true.
And so as this war winds down, is there any kind of, what do you want to call it, accommodation, rapprochement for these objectors, or what became of them?
Well, the British ones, who are the ones whose case I know best because I wrote about it in my book, actually benefited from a real change of feeling that the British public started to have in the 1920s as the tremendous toll of the war sunk in. More and more people were really willing to see it as a waste of lives, as something that shouldn't have happened. And many of the Brits who had spent time in prison as war resistors later occupied prominent positions. I mentioned Edmund Dean Morrell, who spent 6 months at hard labor in 1917, 1918. 6 years later, he was in Parliament and was the Labour Party's chief spokesperson on foreign affairs. Arthur Creech Jones, a resistor who spent more than 2 years in prison, 30 years later was in the British cabinet. Seven or eight others also got seats in Parliament. So I think they were recognized belatedly as people who had some justice in their position.
And what kind of position did they have just barely 20 years later when Germany invades Poland?
I mean, that was a different scene. There were still many people throughout the 1930s who felt Britain should stay out of any war that was coming. There were many others, including some who had resisted the First World War, who said, no, this is a different ballgame this time. There is something quite different about Hitler. And, you know, there were still lines of different political lines that were taken, but it tended more to be people on the right in the late 1930s who were in favor of doing nothing or appeasing Hitler, and people on the left who said, no, we have to get in, we have to get involved.
So in those years between the wars, as the conscientious objectors and those who were opposed to Britain's entry in the war, you know, come back into the mainstream, what's the whole evaluation of World War One? I mean, can the British in particular afford to say it was all a big mistake?
Well, one of the things that makes it hard to come to a fair evaluation of a war when a large number of people have been killed is that nobody wants to believe that their father, brother, son, husband, or these days, you know, daughter, died for a worthless cause. So there's always strong pressure to believe that, you know, this was a sacred aim. Nonetheless, I think the idea that the war was a senseless folly, a waste of lives, began to be fairly widespread in British culture by the late 1920s, early 30s, and has remained fairly well embedded there ever since. That's not the official rhetoric, of course, because from the government, you know, it's always, you know, respecting these brave boys who gave their lives for their country. Nor is it the rhetoric of British academic historians of the First World War, who tend to be dominated by a conservative group, many of whom taught or used to teach at Sandhurst, the British Military Academy, who say, no, the war had to be fought, and it was fought well, and the generals were not fools. They won, after all. I don't agree with these folks, but that's sort of the academic orthodoxy in England, although I think there's a very widespread sense in the popular culture that this war was senseless folly. You can see it in some of the war novels about that period that have been written in recent years by writers who weren't even born when the First World War was going on, like Sebastian Faulks and Pat Barker. But I think the thing that all this points to for me is the importance of making the distinction, when we think about people who've died in a war, making the distinction between honoring and remembering those who've died and honoring the cause that they died for. Because when you look throughout all of history, most wars shouldn't have happened.
And people sending those soldiers to war had vested interests. Do you think it was justified what some people were saying in this country that you know, that this was a war to enrich certain aspects of the economy at the expense of those who fought the war?
Well, there certainly were people, you know, munitions makers above all, who made a lot of money from it, as they do from all wars. Although, curiously, the business elites in 1914 on neither side were beating the drums for war. Prime Minister Asquith of Britain in his diary at one point wrote, "The city," meaning the financial district of London, "does not want war." And this was, you know, in the days just before the war began. You know, because people who do business internationally know they got to trade with other countries, and if you're suddenly going to be at war with the country, Germany, that had been Britain's biggest trading partner, nobody was very eager for that to happen. These days, munitions makers have found, I think, a new way to make money no matter what happens in a war. Look at what's happening in Iraq right now. The U.S. spent $25 billion arming and equipping the Iraqi army. A huge amount of that equipment was abandoned by the Iraqi army, who fled before ISIS, left ISIS all this equipment, and now we're doing drone strikes on ISIS that are aimed at American tanks and guns and things that they now have.
So you're selling it twice, in
effect.
Yeah,
you're selling it twice.
The final analysis, the cost of World War One, and anything whatsoever other than lessons gained?
The cost was enormous, more than 9 million military dead. Civilian dead, depends how you count them, could be as high as 10 or 12 million. Nobody has accurate figures on this. And the biggest cost, I think, was that the bitterness and resentment left behind by the war made a second and even more deadly world war almost inevitable, and the Holocaust to boot. You can see the signs of this. You know, by 1918 in Germany, you know, Jews were being vilified, blamed. You have to, when a war is going badly, you have to blame somebody.
And Jews were fighting in that war
absolutely,
for the Germans.
Absolutely. But they started to be blamed for what was going wrong. There was a census of all Jews in the army that was taken to try to see, you know, were they represented at higher or lower than their percentage in the population. So, you know, the First World War led to the Second, and I think that was, you know, made it an even greater tragedy than all those people who were killed from 1914 to 1918. I think the lesson we can take from it is that there are a couple of illusions that wars always begin with. One is that victory is going to be quick and easy. August 1914, the Kaiser told his soldiers, "You will be home before the leaves fall from the trees." That turned out not to be true. And the other illusion is that people believe a war is going to solve a problem. You know, for Austria-Hungary, it would solve the problem of Serbia stirring up ethnic Serbs within Austria-Hungary. For Germany, it would establish that they and not the Russians should control Eastern Europe. For France, they could get back Alsace and Lorraine. But the war caused so many more problems that it solved, and I think that's something we have to remember when we think about going to war today.
Adam Hochschild, thank you very much for joining me today, and it's been quite a pleasure, insofar as it can be a pleasure, to talk about something as horrendous as World War I.
Well, thank you, Norman. It's been good being here.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can be listening for the next hour of University of the Air.